Good morning, Katha.
Good morning, Sarah.
I'm Sarah Posner, and this is The Posner Show, and today is January 22nd, the 40th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision, Roe versus Wade. And I'm talking today with Katha Pollitt, who's a columnist for The Nation and a poet and an essayist and all-around feminist extraordinaire. And we're going to start out talking about her column this week in The Nation magazine, asking the question, is the term pro-choice passé? And this was provoked by a new campaign by Planned Parenthood called Not in Her Shoes, which was launched with a web video, which basically asks the question of people, you know, maybe you shouldn't judge or make a decision for a woman who decides to have an abortion because you're not in her shoes. And you wrote about this, but you also wrote about, you know, whether the term pro-choice should be completely discarded and why, you know, what the reasons might be for Planned Parenthood deciding to go in this direction that seems to suggest that, well, it's more, this issue is more complicated than the label pro-choice or pro-life.
Yes, I went to their press briefing. It was quite fascinating, and they had a lot of polls there where that showed that people are a little less eager to identify with the label pro-choice, but they still support Roe, the Roe v. Wade decision, which says that a woman has the right to make a decision have an abortion in consultation with your doctor. So there is that contradiction there, and they felt that the word pro-choice itself was hanging up people from identifying with the position they actually held. They did a lot of, they did focus groups, kind of hate focus groups, but that, I guess that's a topic for another day.
Right.
They did a lot of focus groups where people said things like, let me quote here, abortion is a, let's see, it's not just black or white, there's gray. We define it so many times by the extreme of the viewpoints rather than the moderation. Labels don't matter. And then Dawn LeGance, who was their executive vice president of Planned Parenthood, said to me, it was clear from the research that for most of them, their struggle was with what their own decision would be and under what circumstances. So anyway, they feel that if they don't use the word pro-choice so much, or, I mean, it has a historical meaning. You can't never say it, you know.
Right.
But that if they talk about a woman's personal decision and how, you know, you're not in her shoes, that this would call forth a deeper support for abortion rights.
Because people would be more sympathetic to abortion rights if they didn't feel penned in by a particular label?
Well, you know, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, Sarah, but I think you have to ask them this, because to me it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, you know. To me, pro-choice is the historical word. People know what it means. I don't see that personal decision, maybe if we were starting from scratch, you know, what should we call this movement? Let's call it pro-personal decision, pro-decision. Maybe that would have been a little better, because decision is a nice, weighty word, right? And personal reminds people that it's really an individual response to individual circumstances. But, you know, that's not perfect either. I mean, choice does have a kind of slightly frivolous tinge to it, and I think they're right, Planned Parenthood is right, when they say, you know, it now has such consumerist connotations, like your choice of cell phone plan. That it's easy to trivialize this extremely important aspect of women's reproductive rights and freedom. But, you know, you can do the same thing with decision, like, oh, your fancy-schmancy decision to kill your baby. If you think abortion is wrong, it doesn't matter what you call believing in the right of an individual woman to have an abortion. It's always going to sound like a bad thing.
Well, it's interesting that you say that they were talking about, well, choice sounds frivolous because it could be like choosing a cell phone plan or deciding whether to get a cheeseburger or a hamburger. You know, something, you know, it's your choice. But I think, is that something that's been a product of the pro-life movement's demonization of that? You know, the idea that, because the pro-life movement, and we can talk about whether that's an accurate term also still, but the pro-life movement, I think, has capitalized on the frivolous connotation of the word choice and has made it seem that, well, life, that's very weighty. Choice, that's very frivolous.
Exactly. They have done that. And, of course, their colonization, appropriation of the word life was very clever of them. In fact, they're not, you know, when you consider that their lack of interest in what happens to born people, and when you consider the health risks of many pregnancies, it's obvious that life, they're interested in the life of the unborn. They're not interested in the life of the woman, and they're not interested in the life of born people either. But nonetheless, they did latch on to that word, which also elides the whole question of, well, is a fertilized egg a human life? I mean, it's human in the sense it's not a cat, but is it a human in the sense that we are? I don't
Right.
know. I mean, To me, it doesn't have any of the qualities that human being has.
Well, I have to say that, you know, in defense of some pro-life people, I mean, I do know some pro-life people who are, you know, anti-death penalty and anti-torture and pro-safety net, right? So, I mean, but I do think that in the main, the pro-life movement, particularly the politicized movement that's, for example, you know, setting the groundwork for what they hope to be a case that will overturn Roe, and lobbying for the restrictions that are proliferating in state legislatures that are essentially geared towards not just making it more difficult to get an abortion, but, you know, to make it nearly impossible to get an abortion in some places. I think that in the main, because of their focus on abortion to the exclusion of other people, that you're right, that they care about that to the near exclusion of other what could be termed life issues. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think the pro-life, so-called, I wish we've said opponents of abortion rights and supporters of abortion rights. That's really what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that is a little hard to compress. And so we have these monosyllables.
Yeah, yeah.
But getting back to Planned Parenthood's change of label, the opponents of abortion rights are very pleased with this. They see this as a tremendous victory for them. If you look at their blog, you know, they're saying, aha, you see, they finally were forced to confront the fact that this is just a euphemism for baby killing. But now they want to call it some other nonsense. So I don't think this is make very fundamental disagreements about very real things go away by calling it something else, you know.
Well, another aspect of the new Planned Parenthood campaign is embedded in it is the notion that
that bothers me too, because if we look at these things people were saying, you know, we define it so many times by the extreme of the viewpoints rather than the moderation. Well, what does that mean? I mean, to me, that has to mean that since a woman has a legal right to get an abortion for any reason she likes up until, you know, certainly the end of the first trimester, it has to mean less rights for her. That's the only way that moderation can go, right? So what do they mean by that? Do they mean waiting periods are fine? Yes, let's really make sure that women are really considering this carefully. Let's make them look at that all the time. Let's make them listen to that heartbeat, because, you know, a lot of people just rush into this, they don't know what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how do they feel about all those things? I don't think that when people talk about the extremes, it can be a good thing for what I would still like to call the pro-choice movement.
Well, I think that extreme on the side that's opposed to abortion rights conjures up images of people protesting anything from people protesting outside clinics all the way to people with guns hunting down doctors who provide abortions. On the side in support of abortion rights, what is the extreme? When you say it's the extreme, what defines the extreme of that? Somebody who thinks that someone should be able to have an abortion at any time of the pregnancy for any reason. I mean, I don't really know how many people fall into that camp and whether any of the, you know, abortion rights groups fall
Well,
into
I don't
that
think
camp.
They do. And that's another thing that's very strange. I think in America, people like to think the truth lies in the middle. It's the same thing we see with, you know, let's have purple America. Let's just have compromise in Congress, right? And both sides are to blame. Whereas
common ground.
What's going on in Congress, it's pretty clear the Republicans are to blame. I really think that it would be better, rather than sort of moving toward people's confusions and saying, yes, let's look at more individual circumstances. Let's look at more of these personal decisions. Let's look at more of other people's shoes and how you can or cannot walk in them and what you would do if you were in that situation. I think it would be better. And maybe I'm sounding very, abstract or old-fashioned or whatever you want to say, to think about abortion rights the way we think about rights. And the way we think about rights is not to look at the individual way each person uses them. It's to look at the right, which is a right to use a freedom in the way that the individual thinks is best, subject to very few restrictions. Let's say, for example, let's take that First Amendment. People say lots of things that I don't like, right? They say lots of things I think are really harmful. But I understand that freedom of speech includes their right to say all these things I think are a lot of rubbish, right? Freedom of religion includes the right to belong to religions that, you can be a snake handler. You can belong to all kinds of religions that the other religions think are just weird heresy. And we accept that. We don't micromanage what religion people belong to or what they say or how they assemble. But with abortion, it's the opposite. Now why is she having this abortion? Would I have an abortion if I were in that situation? Oh, maybe I wouldn't. So maybe she shouldn't either. That's, to me,
right,
that's
right.
the way
well, just,
that's
just to play Well, you know, I think that conservatives have taken the idea that, ooh, something the government is doing is chipping away at this right. You know, they've tried to take that idea with regard to the Second Amendment for sure. You know, that they say that the Second Amendment right to own a gun is absolute and any kind of gun control chips away at that right. And even in the First Amendment context, you know, conservatives with it just take the most notorious example, the contraception coverage requirement under the Affordable Care Act, and how conservative religious groups are claiming that being forced to provide that coverage, you know, chips away or undermines their right to practice their religion. So I think that the idea that, ooh, we have this absolute right that we've thought of as, you know, unassailable, and the government chips away at it, I think that that is something that conservatives have used to their advantage, I think, in those contexts and with those issues.
Yes, they've certainly tried to expand the notion of religious rights to include things that were not part of it
right.
A time ago. And the same with the Second Amendment. I'm not sure where you're taking that idea, though.
Well, I think that, you know, because you were saying that the, you know, we don't question the circumstances under which, you know, your First Amendment right can be practiced or carried out. And I was pointing out that conservatives have used that kind of tactic to claim that their rights are being undermined. I don't think that there's, particularly in the religious freedom context with the contraception coverage requirement, I don't think ultimately it will be a successful argument in court, even though they have had some success in court with that argument. But I have some doubts about whether it will ultimately be a winning argument for them. But what I'm saying is that it's not the idea that there's this unassailable right, but that somebody's trying to chip away at it is not an unfamiliar one.
Right, but you know, I do think there's something different about the abortion discussion, because it gets so far into the weeds of individual circumstances and decision-making, and then it tries to tell people what to do. And, you know, we just don't do that so much with other reproductive, sexual, intimate relation kinds of decisions, you know? For example, you used to have to give some very specific reasons why you wanted to get a divorce, and that was thought to be the moral thing, and that was good for society and all like that, and all it did was mean that there was just an enormous amount of perjury in divorce court, and now every state has no-fault divorce, where we just say, you know, we're not really that interested in why you're getting a divorce. We're here to, you know, figure out about the property and the children, that sort of thing. And in other ways, it just in personal life, we're getting more, I think, a sense of just it's not really part of public policy why the individual reasons for doing this, except with abortion. And I think, you know, if you compare it, I think it's because it's about women. And women are just this enormous battleground, and everything they do is up for decisions, up for comment and criticism. And people learn how to do this at a very early age, and, you know, critiquing what women look like and how they dress and what they say and who they're dating. And so the idea that all of a sudden you're pregnant and your decision should just be beyond comment is something we're not really trained to do. We're trained to do the opposite. And you saw that yesterday at the inaugural, you know, where Michelle Obama's bangs. upstaged everything, you know, and everybody had to have their little opinion about her hairstyle. I mean, that just seems so weird to me. I think that to me, abortion is really about women and their sexuality and their individuality and their power. And these are all ideas that make people extremely uncomfortable, people of both sexes. Women are the repositories of virtue and of civic orderliness. And when women get out of control and do what they want, this is usually seen as a bad thing, or very often seen as a bad thing, and something that has to be justified.
Well,
we never do this with men. I mean, and an example that I'd like to, you know, call to your attention is the case of Viagra. You know, I mean, and I'm not against Viagra. I think, you know, it's probably, you know, just a blessing for many people. But the fact is, you don't have to be married to get Viagra. You don't have to be planning to conceive a child to get Viagra. Nobody, the doctor's not going to say, are you planning to go use this Viagra with a prostitute? Is this for your girlfriend? Do you have your wife?
Cheat on your wife?
Nothing. Right. It's just you want it. You have the diagnosis. You get it. And nobody has a problem with that. People might, you know, have a problem with that, but it doesn't get anywhere in terms of public policy and prescribing. The same thing is true of vasectomy. Men pretty much get to do whatever they want with their bodies. But when women want to do whatever they want with their bodies, it becomes a whole big deal.
Well, I think that was something like that's good and bad about the Planned Parenthood campaign. You know, the not in her shoes, I think, is probably a good idea. And it's like saying, you know, look, you know, you shouldn't be making this decision for somebody else because you don't know what's going on in her life. But does that matter? I mean, I think that, I mean, to me, you know, it's almost like suggesting that, well, we should probe what it is that's going on in her life to figure out whether we're in her shoes. And by saying that it's complicated and you're not in her shoes, and then that sort of invites somebody to say, well, yeah, I've been there, but I didn't have an abortion because I'm, you know, better than she is and decided to have the child even though I faced all these
exactly.
obstacles and look at me. And so I think it doesn't really matter, you know. I think that the Planned Parenthood thing
invites
that
sort of discussion.
Well, that's
what I think. And I think, for example, now you're seeing this campaign just starting out with the opponents of abortion that rape should not even be an exception. Because after all, there are women who've had children born out of conceived in rape, and those children, this campaign is being led by a lawyer who was one of these children. So some women are up for it, or some women, they did it because they had to, and it worked out. And so it's very hard to say that because, that you can't really know another person's circumstances, and that should be the reason why they get to do what they want. Because first of all, people love to judge. They love to judge. They love to think, oh yeah, if I were in that situation, here's what I would do. And you see this, for example, internet, in comment threads underneath, go to Salon, look at, any personal story, right? And the commenters are very quick to say, oh, well, if you didn't have to do that, look at the other thing you did over here instead of the smart thing you could have done. You can look at any story of why a woman had an abortion, and you can find, if you're minded to, some little tweak where you believe they could have done something. For example, there are a lot of people who believe there's a great deal of help out there for single mothers and children. There are people who believe, like Joe Walsh, the recently defeated representative, who said you never need to have an abortion for health reasons. No one dies because they don't have an abortion. That's a very common belief. People are using their own facts to a certain extent in the abortion debate, right?
But I think also people like to feel better about their own decisions, which is why people like to pick away or analyze somebody else's decision-making process and say, well, I was sort of there once, I was sort of in your shoes once. And I think it's because people like to process other people's decision-making through their own prism or other people's experience through their own prism. If you tell somebody that you recently had some big life event, such as either having a baby or having an abortion or a death in the family or something like that, if you tell somebody that, they will inevitably say, most people will inevitably say, oh, when that happened to me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and laying out their thing. And so I think that you're inviting that conversation as opposed to a conversation about rights and freedom and liberty and, dare I say it, choice.
And another thing is that people do make the wrong decision. And this whole big discussion about, regret and, I did this, but now I'm sorry and, this is so terrible. People sometimes make decisions that they regret. They get married and then they have to get divorced, and there's a story in the Science Times section of the New York Times today that women who marry when they have cold feet, they get divorced. It doesn't go away. They don't feel better. People make mistakes. Why is the fact that you might have an abortion and then be retroactively regretful that you had it a reason to change the law? And so much is that an argument that is persuasive that, Anthony Kennedy, in upholding the federal so-called partial birth abortion ban, said, oh, my God, a woman might have this procedure, and then she might come to regret it. Well, maybe she would, but why is that relevant? The poor little flower, she must be protected from her regret because she's not capable of making a good decision. Well, that is so infantilizing.
Exactly. But also I think that this whole getting into the weeds of somebody else's decision-making and that, it's complicated and you're not in her shoes, is disconnected, I think, from the reality of what most Americans believe on this issue. I mean, there've just been a raft of polls in the last week or so that show a majority of Americans believe that Roe versus Wade should be upheld. And I think just today, and now I have to put on my reading glasses so I can actually see what I'm looking at, a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll found that 70% of Americans want the landmark abortion rights ruling to stay, and only 24% would like to see it overturned. So I think when you ask the question, assuming that people know what the Roe versus Wade decision is about, because there was a poll last week from Pew, which showed a rather alarming percentage of people, particularly those under 30, who couldn't correctly identify what the issue at stake in the Roe decision was. But I think that once you put it in that sort of framing for people without asking, is it complicated? Should we have this full probe of how the woman went through this decision-making process and what the circumstances in her life are? No. I mean, it's pretty basically straightforward. It's 70% is a pretty high number who think that
Roe
should
stand. That's why the opponents of abortion have been very clever in the way that they are framing their campaign against abortion rights, because they, they wanted a human life amendment, which would have constitutionally banned abortion, and they didn't get anywhere with that. And so I think that they understand that people kind of support something called abortion rights, something called Roe, even if they don't know what it is. But so that they work with restrictions. So they work with, okay, if we can have a waiting period that, you know, is 72 hours long, it makes people stay in a, you know, a motel for 3 days or travel, make 2 8-hour round trips from to the one clinic in, you know, South Dakota. That's really good. And in fact, Michael New, who is works for the Charlotte Lozier Institute, which is the research arm, you can call that, of the Susan B. Anthony List, an anti-abortion organization. He said, you know, all these things jack up the price, so that's good. And that's what it's really about. If you can make abortion more expensive, if you can make it more inconvenient, if you can shut down a clinic with these targeted, you know, these trap laws targeted, oh, God, help me out here, what trap stands for. but this is where they try to make very strict regulations, unnecessarily strict regulations for clinics. For example, that's what's happening in Mississippi. Right. That's why the last remaining clinic in the entire state might be closed down, because they said, well, you have to have doctors that have hospital privileges, but the hospitals won't give privileges to any doctors that are associated with that clinic. So things like that are very effective. And I fear that we could be losing abortion rights while Roe is still there.
Right. And I think that one of the things that was in this Wall Street Journal, New York Times, I mean, sorry, NBC poll, was what people sometimes call the enthusiasm gap, or the intensity gap. 74% of those who support overturning Roe, who, you know, they're a minority of the right. overall respondents, but 74% of those who support overturning Roe consider abortion a crucial issue or one of the many crucial issues, and only 31% of Roe supporters said the same thing. And so I think that what you see is you see this sort of overall majority opinion in favor of keeping Roe, and a smaller percentage of those people who actually see it as like a crucial issue and probably then engage politically or in an advocacy or activist kind of way with it. And then you see this other group where the intensity is very, very high, which is why I think you see part of the reason why you see the success with the state level laws that restrict in various ways, either restrict access to abortion itself, such as like the trap laws that you're talking about, or make it more onerous or difficult or invasive, such as, you know, forced ultrasound laws for women.
Yes, I think that's very true. And here relevant too is the whole geographic part of the anti-abortion story, which is you get the most restrictions in the most anti-choice places. So that, you know, you don't see them in New York, you don't see them in California, you see them in South Dakota, or you see them snuck in Virginia, and then going along with gerrymandering to get more Republicans into state legislatures. The action is, a lot of the action is in states now, and it's very much connected with party politics. But I think that, so I think, you know, if you're just a normal person, you don't think about this all the time, it would do, you know, you're living in New York or you're living in California, and, you know, you can get an abortion. We have Medicaid abortion in New York State, and so it doesn't seem to you like something that is going to affect you. And you've probably never been to South Dakota, and it's one of those square states on the map, and you might not really grasp how what happens there can affect eventually what happens all over the country.
But also in the short term, how it affects individuals.
That's right. But, you know, maybe you don't care so much about individuals being in South Dakota. Maybe that's not too high on your list of priorities. I mean, it's sort of an awful thing to say, but look how comfortably this country lived for many, many decades with Jim Crow in the South. You know, that was just all happening somewhere else, and that's their way, and all like that. But I do think that as these restrictions become more severe in places that are not as removed as South Dakota, but are places like Virginia, which is right next to Washington, right, and we hear more about them, I think more pro-choice people will wake up and see that this is really a national issue.
Well, do you think that to use a shorthand, the Todd Akin view of the world being articulated, you know, how he, you know, the comments he made about legitimate rape and how those were echoed by Phil Gingrey recently, or not, you know, echoed completely precisely, but the same sort of idea that and then the comments that were made by Richard Murdoch. And those are two people, Murdoch and Akin, who couldn't win election in their very red states. And, you know, it's hard to say whether it was completely attributable to their comments about rape and abortion, but obviously, those were things that got played in the news quite a bit right before the election and during the campaign. And, you know, speaking of like public relations and using focus groups and things like that to tailor your message, I don't know if you saw recently the conservative pollster Kellyanne Conway told Republicans, look, would you please stop talking about rape? It's not.
Well,
and I thought, you know, please do talk about that if that's what's on your mind, because I think it was a quite illuminating to know that people who are running for Congress or the Senate have, you know, are thinking these things about women and either, you know, the way women's bodies work, or whether it's about how they think women should be, you know, women's bodies
exactly,
should be regulated.
Exactly. I think it's really good that Republicans just say what's in their heart about about all these things, and I worry a little bit that the Susan B. Anthony list is going to have these sort of training sessions for Republican politicians where they'll learn not to talk like this, but they'll still think like this. You know, it's just learning to sort of like, you know, don't say anything about rape. Just the only thing you can say
is that really happening?
Tragedy. They can't talk about it. I don't know if they're actually doing it, but Marjorie Dannenfelser said, yeah, we're going to give them media training, and if they can't pass the media training, then we're not going to support them. So this may have been the golden moment when we found out what these male Republicans, male anti-choicers think about women's bodies and all the rest. But I think that that was really great that people saw that, because what lies underneath the banning of the drive to ban abortion is not very pretty. It really is about regulating women's bodies. And I've always wanted to ask, you know, well, okay, tell me, what do you think will happen if abortion made a crime again? Do you think people won't have them? Well, people will just have all these, you know, a million plus women a year will have babies that they, you know, are then set against not having. And I would just like to know what they say. Do they think, yeah, it'll still happen, but it'll be illegal, and that's good, because what we really want is to make a statement about what kind of country we are. Or will they say, well, no, it won't happen?
Well, it's interesting to me.
You know, people just won't do those things that historically women have done. Throw themselves downstairs and take all kinds of horrific, poisonous substances.
Well, it's the proverbial wire hanger.
They do say that actually, here's operating on their own facts. Again, they do claim that when abortion was a crime, there was much less of it because people don't commit crimes.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because they very frequently I get, you know, press releases in my inbox about, you know, some abortion doctor somewhere who botched an abortion and somebody needs to be rushed to the hospital. You know, this is from an anti-abortion group. In an attempt to prove how terrible abortion is, they say, you know, see, here's a case of a terrible abortion doctor doing this botched abortion, and this woman had this medical emergency as a result of it. And every time I get one of those, I think, okay, you know, that's what's going to happen all the time if abortion were illegal. And, I mean, maybe not even by a doctor, but by, you know, somebody freelancing or somebody self-medicating or whatever. So I just find that so fascinating that in the attempts to prove how terrible and dangerous abortion is, they're kind of making the case about why it should be legal and safely provided by medical training.
Well,
medical
exactly. Except, you know, what then they would say, because I debated people who say this, you know, if they make abortion a crime again, it won't be dangerous because there's antibiotics. So, in other words, legal abortion is very dangerous, as we see by these extremely rare instances of abortions that don't go well. But making it a crime will be fine, because we have antibiotics. It really makes no sense. And that's where you can see that they're using whatever argument they can make that will have the immediate emotional or legal effect they want it to have. But their entire vision is just, we have to get rid of it. We have to ban it. We have to be like most of the countries in Latin America, where abortion is illegal even to save a woman. Or with, you know, exceptions to save a woman's life that are so narrow that, you know, the doctors can't do anything while they try to figure it out and the patient dies. And in all of those countries, there's a tremendous illegal abortion rate. The rate of illegal abortion in, for example, Brazil is higher than legal abortion here. There, as here, people want small families and they want to have children take care of them and all the rest.
Well, Katha, this was a really good discussion.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right, well, hopefully we'll do it again. Okay, thanks.
I'd love to.